The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 31 for the 4th of September, 2008. Back to school. I'm Dan Cohen. And welcome to a new school year and a new school year here at Digital Campus from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, which is now, according to U.S. News and World Report, the number one up-and-coming university. Hey, congrats, Tom and Mills. I suspect this podcast had everything to do with it, right?
I think it does. I think it shows innovation and forward thinking and all of the kinds of things that they were looking for in that survey. So,
and I'm sure many of the college presidents who actually fill out those survey forms are regular listeners.
Of course. Of
right.
course.
They're in our audience. Well, thank you. Thank you there. And, of course, those were the voices of our regulars on the program. Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back. And, of course, I'm Dan Cohen. For new listeners, you can find me at dancohen.org. And we're lucky enough to be joined by a friend of the show and a guest we've wanted to have on for some time now who's done a lot of work with technology and higher ed. It's Brian Alexander. Hi, Brian.
Greetings, gentlemen.
Brian, of course, is talking to us on the ancient 18th century telephones that Vermont uses still. And we tried to get him on Skype, but the Skype gods were not shining on us. But it's great to have you on the show, Brian. And, of course, you are from Knightley at knightley.org, N-I-T-L-E. Do you want to say a bit about what Knightley is?
Sure. And it's very exciting to be here, partly because every time I listen to the show and podcast, it's usually when I'm chopping or hauling wood, and it's getting a little cooler out here right now in Vermont. So just thinking about you guys, the association with wood stacking is very appealing right now. there may be other reasons as well, but that's the first one. Knightley is a nonprofit. We work with primarily small liberal arts colleges and universities across the United States, along with some affiliates in North Africa and Europe. We work with emerging technologies, trying to help our campuses grapple with changes in the cyber technology world. We focus primarily on undergraduate education, so we help campuses dealing with teaching and learning along with scholarship and campus life. We do workshops both online and in face-to-face. We help build collaborations among campuses. We help also provide some information services for campuses exploring new platforms, be they for video conferencing or for course management systems. My part is the research wing. I focus on emerging technologies, and I run a series of projects and services along those lines. We're not based anywhere in particular. We're distributed throughout the United States with staff in about three time zones. I'm in the Vermont part. We have folks in Washington State, Texas, Michigan, upstate New York. Knightley.org, that's N-I-T-L-E. There probably is a K-N-I-G-H-T-L-Y, but that's different. It has a lot of information, including the blog that I run called Liberal Education Today.
It's a great blog. I think that our listeners, anyone who's interested in this podcast, would really learn a lot from your blog. And really, on a day-to-day basis, it's probably the best way to find out about these emerging technologies or stories that are in the news.
We probably get half our stories from there, so it definitely is a place to go.
Right. Well, it's great to have you on the podcast, and I'd like to maybe give you some time at the end of the podcast when we have our picks of the week. I think you're launching really a very interesting new project to predict upcoming technologies on campus. And maybe we'll give you a few minutes to talk about that. I think it's really exciting and innovative. So looking forward to that at the end of the podcast. And, of course, since you are such an expert on emerging technologies in our featured story coming up in about 10 or 15 minutes, we'd like to talk to you about, you know, what you see for the upcoming school year. This is our first podcast this school year, of course, and you know, I think it'd be interesting for our audience to know what you're tracking, what you kind of see on the horizon, or maybe even closer than that, are things that people should be paying attention to and that are going to have some kind of major impact on campus. But first, for our new listeners, might not know that we start with our news roundup of important stories from the past couple of weeks. And actually, since Digital Campus took a August hiatus, European-style August hiatus, we are back from really more than a month, and a lot's happened. But I guess two stories that really caught our eye. First are really just broke yesterday on Labor Day in the United States, was the story that today, we're actually recording this on September 3rd, 2008, that Google is actually going to release a browser today at some point. I've been checking their site at google.com/Chrome. It doesn't seem to be out yet. But what do we think about this? Why is Google entering this market? Is this something that really is going to have some kind of influence on campus? You know, I guess campuses have been really converting to Firefox, and Google's browser will be open source. What does this mean? Is it just more browsers to be confused about, to have to design websites to different browser standards?
Well, my initial reaction was sort of a pit in my stomach for our web designers who are now having to test on IE6, IE7, IE8, Firefox 2, Firefox 3, and now Safari, and now Google Chrome. That's an awful lot of debugging time for our designers. But I think, you know, I welcome more competition in this market. I think listeners know that I use a lot of the Google productivity products, Google Docs, Google Gmail, Google Calendar, and I'm sure there'll be fantastic integration for those products. And I think it's just another sign of Google really trying to enter the operating system market. I mean, if the in a way trying to make the browser become the operating system, and this way they can control the environment much more. I think it's a major development if it flies.
Yeah, I mean, my view is a lot like Tom's, is that I think this is a clear recognition that it's in the browser that people actually live online, and if you want people to be using your products, whether it's Gmail or Google Docs or whatever, the more closely they're aligned with you through a browser, the better. But I also think it's kind of a shot across the bow of Microsoft, because so much of their dominance of the internet marketplace is really based on the dominance of Internet Explorer. And, you know, I mean, I happen to be someone who loves Firefox, but it's, you know, Mozilla is never going to substantially challenge Microsoft's domination of the browser market, but Google really is in a position to do it, largely because of their incredible cash position.
You know, I guess we should say that, you know, when you look carefully at this new browser that's coming, it really is, as Tom noted, I mean, it's not just another browser. It has kind of a different orientation. They released, of all things, a comic book to tell everyone about this browser. And in that comic book, it really points out that, you know, what we're looking at here is something that goes beyond just your standard web browser, which is meant to display pages. It takes much more seriously all the things that have been going on in these Google apps for campuses, you know, like, for instance, Google Calendar, Google Docs. It takes that kind of application environment and makes the browser really serve that rather than, you know, what we have traditionally thought of it for the browser, which is, you know, the display of documents on the browser. So they've done things like optimize JavaScript, which is now the really leading programming language for sort of interactivity on the side of the user. It also allows for offline use, this new browser will, of all the Google apps. So this generally happened through technology called Google Gears, and that will be integrated into the browser, so you'll be able to, one assumes, use, for instance, Gmail offline. It really makes the browser much more like an operating system. There's some more technical details on that fact, too, if you look at this very strange comic book where they talk about, you know, multi-threading and all these things that are generally just talked about in an operating system. They're adding it to the browser, all these fancy sort of OS kinds of technologies. But they're really saying, right, that the browser is where applications will happen in the future, and I suppose that's a trend that in academia we're going to have to listen to.
And it really is a browser. I mean, I think they're really rethinking the browser. And I think, Dan, as you said, really as something that delivers web services rather than something that delivers web pages. And it's sort of a slight shift, but it is a real shift. I think one thing that this is going to do is probably kill off Flock, which was flavor of Firefox. It's an open source browser, but it's run by a private entity. And it was sort of the first browser to think first in terms of web services and sort of second in terms of web pages. And I think, this really is taking in some respects a page out of Flock's notebook and taking it much further and putting the resources of Google behind it. The only other thing I'd say here is that Google has really been the primary financial supporter of Mozilla and the Mozilla Foundation. I mean, most of their funding comes from Google, and I mean, there. If you've ever been to Mozilla, it sits in the shadow. Their corporate headquarters sits in the shadow of the Googleplex, and I wonder what it means for their relationship.
We should note here that Mozilla, of course, produces Firefox.
Yes, right. And so there's some questions there about that relationship. I think earlier in the weekend we saw that Mozilla and Google inked a new agreement for another 3 years of a formal financial relationship. But I think it does raise some questions about where Google's going to go in terms of its relationship with that open source community.
Brian, what did you think when you saw this announcement? Do you make recommendations, for instance, to universities and colleges in the Knightly network about, for instance, you should be using Firefox over Internet Explorer?
That's a great question. We don't make formal recommendations. We explore categories of service and tool, and then we outline the affordances and disadvantages and cost of each one, but we don't formally endorse any of them. We've been following the browser world pretty closely, and in fact, on the futures market, which I'm going to talk about in a bit, Firefox just went down a little bit, which says something. But I have a few different points, and I blogged it this morning on a kind of caffeinated hurry. A few things. One is I'm glad to hear somebody else uses Flock. I'm using Flock right now, and I think that's going to be the primary victim. Flock has been service-based, application-based, and did a lot of groundbreaking work. It hasn't had a lot of traction, and I think this just might put paid to it. I do think there's a crucial piece here, which is Gears. The offline integration is a major move. One of the biggest problems with getting people into cloud computing is it's a major, major behavioral change to get computing off your desktop and trust it and also move it to an offsite location. People aren't always on all the time. Broadband is not ubiquitous. Even on campuses, and I think that kind of integration with offline life is crucial. Microsoft owns that right now by winning the Office Productivity Wars. I think Google's going to have to work Gears a lot harder. A few more things with this, too. The competition with Safari is very interesting. This wasn't built on Mozilla. This is built on WebKit along with some slices of Mozilla. So it's interesting. I mean, one of the big struggles of next year is going to be the battle between Android and iPhone, between Google and Apple, which is definitely a clash of the titans. And I think a lot of this is ultimately aimed at the mobile market. I think that's one of the reasons for picking our WebKit, because it's already out there on mobile phones in the form of Safari. I think that's a major competition. A couple more details that's worth summarizing about the technical features of this. And again, we're working on the comic book and on what we've read. We don't have it downloadable yet. The URL is still 404-ing. The improved memory control, I think, would be a big win if Chrome can actually block the bloat that comes with Firefox. I think that would be a serious drive towards adoption.
We should point out the issue here is that as much as people like Firefox, sort of every time you open a new tab, it sort of expands the amount of memory in your computer that Firefox is using. And one of the things it looks like that Chrome is going to do, and by the way, we should note, which is very odd, that behind the scenes, one of the Firefox sort of infrastructure elements is called Chrome, which I found very strange that they named the browser.
Yeah.
What
well,
is
it gets even weirder. Scoble says that there was a Microsoft project called Chrome a few years ago.
You're kidding.
Huh.
Well, so we should just point out very quickly that evidently this new Google browser will sort of separate out the memory of each one of these tabs, and also if something goes wrong, for instance, with you know, you go to CNN.com and it tries to load some giant video of Anderson Cooper being lashed by rain in a hurricane, and if that takes up a lot of memory, you can just close it out. It doesn't affect the other tabs, at least theoretically.
That's true. That's another key feature of this, is a kind of threaded tabbing. Applications should also run on each tab partitioned out rather than running through the entire browser. So if Anderson Cooper is talking and seizing control of that one tab, you should be able to go over to Twitter in your next tab and complain about CNN's web design without the whole browser seizing up and dying. Another feature about this is the better Java. The idea is that they've built a new virtual machine app called V8, which should load Java and JavaScript a lot faster. TechCrunch, I think, maybe Mashable, was the first to say that this is a huge win for Google because so many Google apps run on JavaScript. You know, you look at the loading of Google Reader or Gmail or Google Docs. Viewing those apps through the Google browser Chrome should be faster, and that's a real win, I think. All right, well, let me back up a little bit and ask everybody, what do you think of the downsides of this? What are the real dangers?
Well, you know, for me, I guess the strange part of this is, and maybe this is because I'm close, as the case may be, to the Zotero project, you know, which is a Firefox extension that we've built here at the center. And indeed, there's many other Firefox extensions for academia, for note-taking, for library systems. And that seems to be completely missing. That whole part of Firefox, which makes it very attractive, not only is it open source, but it's extensible, it's themable. You can really kind of configure Firefox how you want it. And that's been the power of Firefox, not just the fact that it's free and open source, and obviously the main competitor to Internet Explorer. But I kind of worry about that. I mean, is Google going to have that same kind of architecture that allows you to extend their browser, alter it, etc.?
That's a good question. Is it going to be like null and be closed, you know, admission only, or is it going to be more open, like the various possibilities around a dig-style search result where you can vote things up and down? I think there's two levels of problem to that, Dan. One is it might partition out the developer's world. So as I think Mill said earlier, now we have this problem of yet another platform to develop content for. Well, people working on excellent extensions like Zotero really now have to think, okay, if it's possible, we'll be able to do this. And there's a question of, will Google try to build in some kind of backwards compatibility, which might be impossible? That's one major downside. I agree.
I mean, obviously, we haven't seen much of this, but it does seem, if it's being built on WebKit, well, we know Safari's built on WebKit, and Safari doesn't make it terribly easy to build any kind of plugins or extensions or even really toolbars. I don't know if that would transfer over to Chrome, but Dan, I absolutely think that's a concern. I think there's also a concern of, you know, every time I sign up for a new Google service, I started using Google Notebook over the weekend when I've been trying to write something. And
are you being paid under the table or something for these Google endorsements, Tom?
No, I'm really not. But this is my worry. Is like I'm you know, I've totally drank the Kool-Aid. I've bought in. And am I, you know, and I'm even thinking of buying an Android phone. And Brian, I think you're absolutely right that this is an important development for the mobile, for the mobile market. Am I going to end up in the same place where I was with Microsoft and Windows in, you know, 2000, 2001, where I was just desperately tied to a platform that I didn't really like and I wasn't really happy, with the direction that they were taking? That I think is a worry. You get into the Google universe, and it looks like it's easier to get out of, but it may not be.
Well, clearly a lot more to come on this. I guess for next Digital Campus 32, we'll have to take a look at this Chrome browser and see what we think.
Can I add one more thing to this?
Yeah, sure, please.
Yeah, actually, two quick notes. One is the Safari comparison about extensions. I think is a very subtle one, a very apt one. We can compare the Apple iPhone App Store to the announcement of the Android's marketplace. You know, Apple famously has the one-shop mentality of everything being the Apple universe, and that appears in apps in the App Store with the control over what's available there. And Google last week, one of the developers on the Android side said that they're developing something more like YouTube, an open marketplace for applications for Android. One wonders if they'll take that kind of approach to Chrome. The second thing I want to say before we move on is to go back to what you asked me before, Dan, and actually answer it. We've noticed that a lot of our campuses, again, about 150 small campuses throughout the U.S., have had issues with supporting Firefox depending on where they are. One question is always the open source idea of supporting a product that doesn't have a commercial vendor that you can negotiate with or deal with in the usual politics of open source. A second problem is the extension one, which can allow an awful lot of user control, but for a public lab or for even user machines that are locked down, that can be a bit of an issue. That said, the greater power of Firefox has really been a win for many campuses. I don't know if Chrome will apply that way, but there was a column this morning, I think on CNET, asking should CIOs be Chrome, and the argument was you should look at it if you're a CIO, simply because, not because you will decide to adopt this week or not, but because some of your users already will, and you'll have to cope with it. And that's been Google's strategy for a long time, not engaging the enterprise, but seeping in through individual adoption.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Well, boy, a lot. We could probably do a whole show on this, and maybe we will. In the coming weeks, we'll take a really strong look at it. Just briefly, I guess another thing that happened in August, the whole month, there were rumors about Amazon extending their new ebook reader franchise, the Kindle, into the school market. Particularly for textbook markets, we've talked about the Kindle before on this show, and we know that university presses are licensing content for the Kindle. It does seem like, I've been skeptical a little bit about the Kindle, but textbook market, they're expensive, you carry them around, they're hard to update. Is an ebook reader, Mills, you've talked a lot about the Kindle. What's your thought about this, this potential? Although now they're saying, the sort of late-breaking word is that from Amazon is that they won't release this in 2008, but they're investigating it for the future.
Well, they already missed the 2008 launch.
Right, I guess that's the point.
Well, school's already started, so they missed that. I'm not enthusiastic, and the reason I'm not enthusiastic is because I think textbooks aren't any good anyway. And so taking a product which isn't any good and digitizing it just makes it digitally not any good. And so the problem doesn't get better. The textbooks don't improve just because you put them on some little mobile device. It's much better for the publishers, so because they can update them more rapidly and they can, come out with a new edition more easily and things like that. I'm not enthusiastic at all.
Brian, do you have a Kindle? Have you, or an ebook reader?
No, I'm thinking about it for the winter, and I'm trying to figure out if I want to get one with the winter solstice rush, or if I want to put off my greedy Tetna lust for January. If there's a price break following that, I'm an ebook reader, but I usually read on other devices. I spent several years reading short stories and novellas on Palm Pilots, and I'd use the Sony one. I would have picked it up a couple of years ago if I would have known it had such a large population of material. For me, a major issue with the Kindle is a very simple one. It's like the old Apple issue. At price point, it's very expensive. $360, even if you get the $100 price break from that credit card deal, you still have to pay a credit card fee there. That's a serious chunk of change. I think I would personally make that back by book price savings about a year. And that's a hefty check for change. I do think it's a fascinating tool for all sorts of reasons. We've got, and you guys have touched on several of these before, the format issues, the copyright issues, the charging for New York Times or charging for other free web content. It is kind of fun to read Apple blogs and have Apple blogs complain about DRM or visual content control in the Kindle. But I think when it comes to the textbook world, I think price point is still going to be a big issue. That's you're talking about, you know, the price of 20 novels or maybe a chemistry textbook. That's a big price chunk to ask for people to buy. I think maybe if they release a student version that's lower cost, then they may have a better chance of winning a larger market.
Yeah, and I would just like to add on to that. I mean, I think that students are unlikely to spend their scarce technology dollars on that that kind of a platform. I think they're much more likely to go out and buy themselves the coolest new phone available, whatever that happens to be this semester. And so if I were the CEO of a textbook company, I would not be investing my resources in getting my textbook onto a Kindle. I'd be trying to figure out ways to deliver my content to iPhones and other similar kinds of phones instead, because I think that's what the students are going to want, and that's what they already have. And so to expect them to plunk down several hundred more dollars on this thing, which is really, to their mind, only usable for school, I think it's just not going to happen.
Do you think some hardware manufacturer in Nokia or Ericsson or whoever will try to produce a phone optimized for ebook reading under the Android platform? You know, with a wider screen and perhaps nicely positioned buttons?
I think it's certainly within the realm of possibility, and if they're not thinking about it, somebody ought to be.
I think the other place that we could look for possible ebook readers are with these new netbooks that are out there, the EPC and its clones. I think those Linux-based platforms, which are currently selling for about the price of a Kindle. Yeah. Or less, and but have a fully featured web browser and fully featured operating system, but could just very easily, with some screen quality enhancements and software updates, function as an ebook reader. I think those are another place to look for competitors to the Kindle.
I think that's right. I know I've been playing with an EPC for the past few months, and that's been my major use of it. I have to confess, I've got big, fat fingers. And I have a hard time using the EPC for that. You know, it puts me in phone mentality, but it makes me miss the tablet. You know, I think the tablet PC is a great ebook reader. That's how I used to use my tablet all the time.
Right,
you know,
right.
Grab a stack of PDFs and you're good.
Makes sense.
So, can I ask another question on this, Dan?
Sure.
It seems that, and forgive me if I'm missing something, but it seems that our conversation is very U.S.-centric. And that's often the case with digital technology when it comes to education. The rest of the world's experience is very different. You know, we have people reading books on mobile phones in Japan and in Russia. That hasn't caught on in the U.S. There was an announcement this morning, Nokia, I don't know if you guys saw that, they're launching a competitor to the iTunes Music Store. And they're launching it first in England, then in Europe, then in Asia. They have no plans for an American rollout right now.
No, I think this is a great point. And indeed, you know, in December of last year, Tom and Mills and I really identified mobile as being, you know, really the critical trend, and even, you know, for content delivery as well as other things. And I think that is where, you know, that is the device that most of the world has, that most of the world is using in, you know, a wider array of ways than in the U.S. market. And, you know, certainly for something like book content, you could see with a larger screen, Nokia rolling out something very successful there.
And I would also point to the we've seen pictures in the last couple months of the new EXO laptop, the new one laptop per child, the EXO 2, and in fact they've kind of redesigned it as an ebook reader, and in fact it actually has the form factor of a book, where it opens and closes on a vertical axis, and really is designed as an ebook reader for the developing world.
I have to admit, I felt techno lust in my heart when I saw that. Like, yes, I need to have that. So we had some great conversations last June. We were doing some workshops at a Moroccan university, and we'd just been working with a lot of American libraries academic libraries, and a lot of librarians have the now classic goal of trying to get more people to use the library and all the different parts of that. And when we were working with librarians, they're meeting in Morocco. They're from Dubai, from Qatar, from Cairo. They had the opposite goal. They had plenty of population. The problem is their physical book collections were so poor that they didn't have much to show. For them, e-book readers, any digital text, was just a serious win. They had a major, major demand for that. And it was supply was really the question. And I bet, you know, seeing textbooks on e-book readers, whatever the platform, be it the Android, be it the, as you said, the one laptop per child, be it one of the EPCs or whatever, I think that's a major, major win. And in fact, maybe the best way to have this kind of conversation is to start first by looking at the rest of the planet to see what people are actually doing and then see how that trickles down to the second tier of development, which is the U.S.
That's a great point. Well, let's get to these and other issues in our featured segment about up-and-coming technologies. Well, we almost didn't need a break. We were rolling right into interesting discussion about some of these trends for the future, including things like, you know, what Chrome raises about applications taking on another format in the web world and the impact of the international market. Why don't we roll right in? You know, Brian, you were talking about you go around, you do these workshops. You know, what are you showing people that's new, and what are you hearing from people around at these 150 colleges that they're starting to experiment with that you really see as something big for the 2008-2009 school year?
It's we definitely follow the classic crossing the chasm pattern. You've got small proportion of early adopters, roughly 5-10%, and then the you know, the bulk in the mainstream, and then the people who call themselves Luddites, but I'd like to get them to think of themselves as Amish. And you know, unless they're violent, you know, it's the lifestyle. They should just call themselves Amish and get over it. But the mainstream people for the next year are still largely inhabiting the course management world. That's a major, major transformation of the landscape.
So by course management, you're talking about Blackboard systems, things like that?
Blackboard is the they're the bear. They've got something like 90% of the market, along with the two big open source competitors, Moodle and Sakai. There are a few others out there, you know, Desire to Learn, Angel, and of course, within the Blackboard world, there's WebCT, but within that world is a significant thrum of development, and campuses are often deeply invested in that. There's no easy way to disengage from those. So if you're in Blackboard, you're pretty well settled into it. And there's a lot of creativity from users going into that. So I think that's where the mainstream proportion is still going to spend time thinking about how to run discussion boards, how to handle e-reserves, how to handle the timing of announcements and so on. That's not bleeding edge, but that's where life is for an awful lot of people. By people, I mean faculty, but also librarians who have to manage e-reserves or try to win a tab inside a Blackboard class, and also technologists who have to do the level of support for it. From the emerging part, this year I was expecting to see a lot more interest in gaming and virtual worlds, and that I think has paused. The paper says that virtual worlds are on the downside of the hype cycle. They're entering the crash phase before people realize how to grow them and make them work in a more suitable fashion. Gaming, I don't think, has gone through quite the hype cycle in higher education, but it's definitely been a hard sell. People are very afraid of games for a lot of reasons, economic, the reputation of gaming. As a fun exercise, I ask people to identify themselves as gamers, and the majority won't come anywhere close to that. And then if I ask, maybe you've played a computer game in the past year, it's 99.5%. That's something that surprises me, and perhaps we'll see some more high-profile experiments like Castronova's Arden. We may see more of that. We may see something come out of the crash of Second Life. We may see some more projects based on other platforms. Sony's At Home might come out. But I think that's still going to be very small. Social software is really where a lot of the creative work is, because there are so many bloggers out there, and faculty, and staff, technologists, librarians. There's so many uses. The edge of blogosphere keeps growing. I think there's so much work to be done there, along with the boom in new applications. Every few days we see some new spin. This past year, there's been a lot of interesting experiments with using Twitter in the classroom. We'll see more and more of that over the next year, I think. Mobile and wireless computing is something I've been keeping an eye on. I think once the Android platform gets commercially released and different hardware sets, I think we'll start to see a lot more interest in that. The iPhone seems to be having the impact that OS X does. That is not numerically large, a small proportion of the market, but very influential in terms of design and reputation. So by spring, once we get different handsets out there, I think we might see people rethinking mobility, pushing content out, examining how students socialize that way, looking at impact on study abroad and on campus life, town-gown relations, service learning, that kind of thing.
And do you think that the multi-touch interface is something that we're going to see expand out? As you said, I mean, if Apple is not good at building big numbers of users but really good at influencing the direction of the marketplace and future technologies?
Yeah, it will, but there's a serious limitation, which is that it's hard to type in multi-touch. It's hard to type on an iPhone for most users.
That's a great point.
A keyboard. And for academia, sooner or later, we have to type stuff up. In fact, for a lot of academia, perhaps half of the disciplines, you begin by having to type. And I think that's going to be a perpetual limitation. You may have people moving content between different stations in an information in a device ecosystem. That is, you know, reading something on an iPhone or on an Android clip phone with multi-touch, and then moving to a desktop or a laptop to write about it. But I think that's one limitation. Another is academia. We are not always happy with things being playful. We're not very keen on games. We think that games or play are often things for K through 12. That's not that, and the multi-touch definitely has an aura of delight and play, and that's another hurdle to overcome.
And do you think that that is also influencing this, what you were calling a kind of downward trend in terms of virtual worlds and their prospects for adoption on campus?
Definitely. Catch that one. Second Life strode forth and rapidly became the dominant player in that field. But then last year, it hit a serious population plateau. One of the Law & Order Empire shows did a Second Life episode. And afterwards, there was no population increase in Second Life. And that was a real serious wake-up call to quite a few people, saying, wow, the adoption of Second Life is too hard. Meanwhile, the population has stayed about the same, about 500,000. And all the problems that higher education has run into haven't gone away. The bandwidth demands, the graphics card demands, the repeated iterations of the client downloads, the problems with content that offends different sectors of higher education, be it sexual or gambling or whatever, not to mention learning curves. It takes an hour to be able to walk around in Second Life and not look like an idiot, much less developing content. So with all that kind of, you know, higher education in many ways considered Second Life, poked at it, and then it's like 3D animation. It's something that a few people use. There's no easy replacement. There's lots of little platforms out there, Mixi, Lively, 3D chats, 2D, 3D platforms, but none have strode forth to really compete. Croquet is still chugging along, and that, like Zotero, is an academic product.
Open source virtual world.
Right.
Yes.
Croquet is a full name. The main staff for that have just moved across the country to Duke, and they're, I think, finished settling in, and they'll be ramping that up. So that's an option. That's being used by a few places like University of British Columbia. That's a pause right now. We'll see if that transforms into the spring semester.
So what is actually heading up on the steep part, the upward steep part of the hype curve, since you do deal with, you know, what I guess not necessarily the listeners to this podcast, but, you know, regular people at these colleges, what do you think is gaining adoption and that we'll see more of this year? Is it something like microblogging or Twitter, or are there things we're missing out on?
Much as it's, for me, strange to say, I think wikis are really going to increase. And the major reason for wikis increasing in use is Google Docs. I mean, whether or not Google Docs or wikis, I mean, they're close enough, but they have two major advantages. One is they don't use the name wiki, and for academia, that's a huge win. The name wiki sounds awkward to a lot of people and has resonances of Wikipedia. The majority of faculty that I speak with do not know that there are wikis beyond Wikipedia. And if you say, use wikis in the classroom, it's a bad start. The second is that Google Docs doesn't have any markup. And wiki markup, as I found for a decade of teaching of this stuff, wiki markup is an issue. Even though it's light, even though it's minor and easy to do, it still is a psychological block for most users. Google Docs doesn't have that, easy to use. Plus, it has that little, what some people have called the world's smallest massively multiplayer online game. You know, you're editing a wiki doc and you can see Dan Cohn is editing this too.
That's the
real win.
Yeah.
And with the positive reputation of Google among people and the fact that it doesn't require an enterprise install,
yeah,
I think we'll see more and more of that. And then other wiki platforms will increase.
Right. And just for our audience, the markup you're talking about is, you know, if you edit, for instance, in Wikipedia, you have to sort of learn a whole grammar for how you make something italicized or a bullet list or a different section. Something like Google Docs, it's just you select some text and press on the bold button to make it bold.
Yeah. Easy is good. Convenience is not to be underrated. I think listening to podcasts might increase, as well as production. Listening, of course, far outpaces production. But once NPR adopted podcasts, suddenly every other faculty member I talked to, they knew all about podcasts. I think that's the single greatest uniting factor in education in the U.S. is NPR. I think nothing else unites us. We are the NPR tribe. But they're not as glamorous as YouTube. But the audience, all the metrics I've seen shows the podcasts keep increasing in listenership. I don't think the net generation, we can talk about the complexity issues around that, but I think the average teenager doesn't come in listening to podcasts as a default activity. But I think it's pretty easy to assign. Once a faculty member gets over the hump of trying to find good podcasts, then, you know, I think we may see more of that. And producing podcasts just gets easier and easier every month. So that might be something to watch. One interesting spin about that, and then I change subject, which is I've been seeing more and more audio in YouTube. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Huh. Just straight audio files in
yeah.
YouTube. No
yeah,
video component.
Huh. Yeah, the video is a single picture that's just a placeholder.
Huh.
I've heard this from several different campuses where people upload audio to YouTube because it's easier than getting campus hosting sometimes, and it's easier than uploading through iTunes on the campus. And because YouTube is such a well-known platform, if you want exposure, there's that. I've been finding some cool, classic YouTube-style content, stuff ripped from other media. I've been finding things, spoken recordings, audio performances. Yeah, it's interesting. It's not easily found, but it's there.
Well, while we're on YouTube, how about video? That's probably for the mainstream audience beyond academia. That's been the big story the last year is just the explosion in, watching video online or through the web, YouTube and other sites.
I think from a consumption angle, that's huge. There's one problem with the consumption, which is that it's difficult for faculty to be able to sift out content in a predictable way for a syllabus. It's pretty easy to make an ad hoc assignment. Okay, we're reading Dickens for next week. Go through YouTube and see what you can find on Victorian social conditions or whatever. But because YouTube content is often ephemeral, because there are issues with copyright, and because searching YouTube is not something that most faculty will confess to in public, it's something which you're not going to see as much in syllabi. I think students are already consuming it, and it's a question of capturing that interest. On the production side, there's still a lot of interest in making video. For Nightly, our video workshops, we do a whole bunch of these. We teach Final Cut Pro, we teach iMovie, we do digital storytelling. These are always in huge demand. But if you're doing digital video, you know that it's enormously time-consuming to make if you're a faculty or a staff member, and to have students make it. Students may have greater facility with the technology, but you still have to build an apparatus for support. Someone has to tell the students, please don't upload pre-rendered video to the campus network. Somebody has to show them where the DVD burners are, that kind of thing. That's a major hurdle, and campuses are solving it, but not on the scale of, say, Blackboard adoption. It's still on the scale of early adopters.
So what else beyond multimedia, then, are you seeing?
No, actually, those are two of the big ones. I mean, virtual worlds, of course, are a form of 3D multimedia, and we already touched on that. Images are something which is simply part of our work. There are some interesting projects in that. David Green did a great study about how people actually use digital images in teaching. And there's some fascinating projects, like watching how ArtStore gets used by what departments and what pedagogical uses. Looking at the slowly growing amount of people using Flickr in the classroom, I mean, Flickr has really emerged as this titan for social image sharing that's way beyond Picasa or PhotoBucket or 23HQ or any of the other ones. As a classroom use, though, it's still kind of slow, and there are good reasons for that. It's to make Flickr content, you have to make a Yahoo account, and that's kind of akin to getting dental surgery. It's much, much harder than making a Google account from scratch. And it's also, there are issues that people have worries about Flickr. What if Flickr goes away? How do we maintain content? So there's some worries about Yahoo and its control over content, some cases of that. But images are right now kind of just growing steadily.
Brian, one thing I'm wondering about is you travel around to a lot of campuses. How do you see the role of digital scholarly production changing or over the next course of the next year? I mean, one of the things we talked about this summer on the podcast and we've been tossing around for a while now is, how we can make digital scholarship count and what really constitutes digital scholarship.
Right.
How do you see the reputation of digital scholarship changing or not changing?
Well, there are a few angles to this. And one is the do you guys see that article from CIO.com about a year ago called The Shadow IT Department?
No. What did it say?
Just Google that. Shadow IT Department, CIO.com.
And we'll link to it from our show notes for our listeners,
right.
Yes.
There might be two versions of it right now because it's popular, but it's the same idea. Basically, meaning that faculty and staff and students are increasingly relying on IT support from people off campus. The term is a kind of playful one. It's a shadowy one. So if you think if you're a CIO at an American campus, your population is increasingly relying on IT needs from people that you can't see, that you can't call or contact, and that's something which can be threatening as well as liberating. More than a few campuses, for example, have told me that they're happy to give up supporting email to go to Gmail. They don't want to have their staff compete with Google developers, for crying out loud, and that way they can free up time to do something else. When it comes to digital scholarship, increasingly, it seems to be the shadow IT department who supports that. People go off and get their own domain names. They go off and they use Blogger or TypePad or somebody else to host their content. It's hard to actually get your arms around just how big that world is simply because it's a killer to research. You can't just go through domain names. There are too many. I mean, there's dancohen.org, for example. But they're, from my alma mater, University of Michigan, is Juan Cole, who runs Informed Comment. Almost nothing on that page smacks the University of Michigan, and yet he's become a leading scholar as well as a leading activist in Middle Eastern studies and in modern politics as a result. I mean, that's one angle. There's a kind of shadow world of that, which is, outside of academia, not shadowy at all. In some ways, that increasingly becomes our public face. So I think one answer to your question is how in academia we are rethinking the role of the public intellectual. Are we still mad at Carl Sagan for being the most influential scientist for a decade? Do we still think that Noam Chomsky is a political activist rather than a linguist? It's a real question how we value that internally within the academy. The second piece of your question is, I should back up, Knightley works really closely with the Ithaca Harbors group. Ithaca Harbors is a group that incubates several different projects. They came out of JSTOR. They help run and support, rather, groups like ArtStor, Portico, Luca, and they've been very, very helpful in supporting Knightley for some time. Ithaca Research, led by Roger Schoenfeld, has been doing some great research about how faculty look at digital information, how they look at libraries, how they look at digitization. And one thing that they keep finding is that faculty tend to not really look hard at digital scholarship. They'll use it instrumentally. They'll use Google Scholar to get at something more conveniently than by going to the library. But it's still something which is considered with some degree of trepidation. I'd follow Ithaca Research to see what they find as they iterate these studies, but that still seems to be a problem. The model that worries me is what I think of as the Soviet model, where it takes a generation of change to pass. I don't mean a digital generation. I mean an offline generation of time. It might take that because we still see the whole stack of rewards, not just young faculty, but department chairs, division leaders, deans. And that takes some time. my optimism comes from the public scholarship point of view.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast before of just, the fact that there is a deeply seated sort of entrenched system in academia and, for tenure and promotion and producing manuscripts and publishing manuscripts, et cetera. And the web and new media just, it doesn't fit neatly into that. And it's hard to see how a transition could take place, perhaps any more quickly than a real generation. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there, Brian, but these are so many interesting threads, and it'll be great to follow comments at digitalcampus.tv on this episode, episode 31. If people can think of other trends that they see in digital scholarship or larger IT issues on campus, people can feel free to link to them from there. Thanks, Brian, for this incredible summary of our upcoming year on tech and the campus.
My pleasure, Dan. Thanks for coming on, guys.
And it's time for, we have a few minutes left for our picks of the week. I guess, Brian, if we could go back to you, I think beyond what you've just said, Knightly is actually tracking up-and-coming trends in a really novel way. Could you talk a little bit about that for your pick of the week?
Sure. We just launched something this week, the Knightly Prediction Markets, as an experimental service. If you go to markets.knightly.org, and there'll be a link to this in the show notes, I'm sure, you'll be able to see how this works. A prediction market is a fake futures market. It's one which uses pretend currency to try to get a handle on emerging trends. The most famous one is from the Iowa Political Science Department, where starting two generations ago, political scientists set up a mock trading service for presidential candidates. That is, over the weeks of the campaign, you could buy or sell stock in one candidate or the other. And as you, as a player, perceived and reflected on the world, you would then express that by buying or selling shares. So if a candidate said something that you thought was very effective, you might buy some stock in them. If they embarrassed themselves at the gap, you could then sell. And the Iowa futures market has actually been quite accurate in predicting candidates up until this year. There's several other examples of this. Google, speaking of the Google Kool-Aid, Google runs an internal one, which you can read about online. It's not available online, but there's at least one scholarly paper published on it and several different popular press accounts. There are a bunch of services out there that do this. I don't follow sports at all, but I'm told there are quite a few examples from that world. But we wanted to experiment and see how this could work for getting at a better knowledge of emerging trends in teaching and technology. So starting about a year ago, we explored this by launching a quiet pilot of a service with using the Inklings platform out of Chicago. And we set up a bunch of trends. We worked with a group of advisors who helped us form propositions and shares, like, will mobility become a greater issue in campus IT support over the next year? Will Firefox become the leading browser on campuses by the end of December 2008? And we found that it was a pretty interesting platform and that it was pretty solid, so we launched it publicly this week. And we've gotten some really interesting results, watching shares go up and down, watching comments that come with that. And it's a great example of wisdom of crowds or distributed intelligence. We get to trade, we mean Knightly staff, if we like, but the key thing is watching faculty, deans, staff from our campuses then participate and buy and sell shares. Every 2 weeks, we release a couple of new stocks for people to play with and see how it goes. But already, it's very interesting to watch. I'd love to hear feedback from anyone, and please sign up and play. It's free. We'd love to see you trade.
Well, that sounds great. Really interesting, and I'm actually mesmerized sitting here watching the stocks of various proposals go up and down. I think it'll definitely be a place to keep an eye on and indeed participate in. Thanks, Brian. Tom, maybe we go over you for a quick pick of the week.
Sure. I've got it's a series of two blog posts. It's on the TechCrunch blog, and it's written by or given by a guest blogger, Jason Calacanis, who a lot of people will know from various venues, including the Twit podcast and other places. He's an internet entrepreneur, and he has two posts on how to demo your startup, part one and part two. And it's really just a tip from someone who's seen a lot of demos and given a lot of demos for new web-based projects and services. about how to give a presentation and how to demonstrate your new tool or your new website. It is geared towards an entrepreneurial business audience, but I think there are a lot of good tips in there for academics working on projects as well. There's a lot of things like good advice, pieces of advice like avoid PowerPoint, that the best products take less than 5 minutes to demo, leave people wanting more, things like that. There's some good tips there, and he goes into some detail about how best to make an impact with a short presentation of your web-based product.
Terrific. All right, thanks. And again, we'll link to this from digitalcampus.tv. Mills, how about you?
Well, I'm going to take just a second and for my pick of the week, shill my my big web project on 1989.
It's absolutely. Fantastic project. Yeah.
Making the History of 1989. We launched it formally last week. It's about, I'd say, 90% of the content is up and online now. We're starting to get some good traffic. And this is a website on the end of communism or communist rule in East Central Europe, or the region we used to call Eastern Europe. And it's one of our educational projects, kind of part of our general world history empire at the Center for History and New Media. And it includes both an introductory essay on what happened in 1989, but also interviews with scholars, a database of several hundred primary sources, all of which are annotated, and all of which you can also see the short version or the long version, and then a variety of teaching resources specifically targeted both high school AP teachers and also college-level teachers. So we're really excited about the project. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about it this fall at various conferences, and I hope people will go take a look and tell us what they think.
Great. Thanks, Mills. A really terrific project, beautifully designed based on the Omeka platform that we've talked about before, and with really incredible content. I mean, I thought I knew a little bit about 1989, but there's so much there for a general audience and even specialists to learn from, including first-time digitized materials. Well, quickly, I'll just talk about my pick of the week. I'm teaching a course on digital history this fall. And as part of that, I wanted to have students able to create their own websites quickly, even if they didn't know HTML. And so I did a full survey of some of the web services that are out there that help you create sites quickly without downloading a giant program like Dreamweaver. And looked at Weebly, looked at Google Sites, or Google Pages, and looked at a bunch of things and actually came to the conclusion that a site I had never heard of before actually had the best service for novices to just put up a quick website that looks good, and it's called Synthesite, SynthaSite.com. Brian, have you used Synthesite before?
I haven't. I've looked at it. It's
They just did a massive upgrade. They've been around since 2006, but I think because of Weebly in particular, they made it all dynamic, and you can sort of drag and drop video onto it and skin it really easily, and it comes with a bunch of different looks in the same way that you can change the look of your blog really easily using themes. And so I found it pretty easy. Obviously, it's geared toward the kinds of people who want to sort of create a site and put advertising on it and make money from it. But I think just for a simple, if you want to create a quick 5-page site and just sort of show it to a class and talk about the ways in which, why you put an image there or some text here, I think it's a really great way to do it. And again, that's at synthesite.com. And of course, we'll link to all these things, including that incredible new nightly prediction market from our website for the podcast at digitalcampus.tv. You also, if you go to that site, you'll find many ways to give us feedback, including via email and actually by a telephone number, as well as just commenting straight on our blog. Brian Alexander from Nightly, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian. It's great to hear from you.
Thanks, Brian.
This has been a lot of fun.
Okay. And we'll see you all again and listen to you all again in another couple of weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do.